Okay, now for something completely different, I think. We've seen, we've already heard from the first three speakers, very different but similar, very different approaches in terms of the entity that's carrying them out and the, but very similar desired outcomes of essentially providing more information to the market to make decisions about chemicals. All of this does ultimately end up translating, I hope, into national policy, and that's what I'm going to talk about today. First, my disclosure, I have no financial relationships or conflicts to report. So what I would like to spend the next few minutes talking about is the landscape that we face at the federal level in seeking to reform one of the laws that Martin described, the Toxic Substances Control Act. This is a law that was passed in 1976. Its core provisions have never been amended in those 37 years since then. For the last several Congresses, a bill introduced by Senator Lautenberg, who was the longtime champion on this issue, called the Safe Chemicals Act, was reintroduced in April of this year, April 10th. It immediately garnered about a quarter of the Senate as co-sponsors, but you'll note that all of those co-sponsors were Democrats. And in fact, in the prior Congress, that bill got as far as a vote in the Environment and Public Works Committee in the Senate. It passed out of that committee on a 10-8 vote, all 10 Democrats voting for it, all 8 Republicans opposed to it. So that situation of essentially gridlock in terms of moving legislation was what we faced even after the reintroduction of that bill this year. So just a little bit over a month and a half later, another bill popped out. And Lautenberg was a lead co-sponsor of that bill as well. That was called the Chemical Safety Improvement Act, or CSIA. It also has about a quarter of the Senate as co-sponsors at this point. But interestingly, Lautenberg's lead co-sponsor was Senator David Vitter, probably the strongest champion for the chemical industry in the U.S. Senate today from Louisiana. And they've been joined by 25 co-sponsors, equally divided between Democrats and Republicans. So how did that happen in, what is that, 6 weeks? Well, something happened in between here. About May 1st, Senator Vitter was on the verge of introducing his own bill. I'm calling it the Vitter Bill because it didn't have a title, and I'm grayed out here because it never got introduced. In fact, what happened was there was a considerable likelihood that that bill would be introduced with several Democratic co-sponsors who happened to come from states with a heavy industry presence who were up for re-election in 2014. And several of those Democrats were concerned about signing on to a bill that was seen as too associated with the industry. So they pressured both Lautenberg and Vitter to work toward a compromise. And in fact, that's what led to the May 22nd introduction of CSIA. The drama was far from over because 11 days later, Senator Lautenberg passed away. A remarkable turn of events that was quite devastating, I think, to those of us working in this area, both because of his leadership and also because of the implications for what would happen to this first ever bipartisan opening to actually move toward TSC reform. So that's kind of the history of how we got to a bill that has been very controversial, but also opens up a pathway for the very first time in the 37-year history of this law to actually contemplate the idea of a new TSC. So what I want to do is to spend some time going through it in a bit of detail so that you have a feel for How the bill goes about addressing the key flaws in the Toxic Substances Control Act, but also some of the limitations and concerns about the bill as introduced. All of these slides, by the way, I've uploaded as a handout, so it should be available to those of you with access to the online program. But let me walk through a series of slides that give you this set of information on different key topics. And the first one is the standard of safety by which chemicals are to be judged, and the basis for making what is called, in the language of the bill, a safety determination as to whether the chemical meets or does not meet the standard. So under TSCA, we do have a safety standard of sorts. It's called unreasonable risk, and it is based on a cost-benefit analysis. So EPA not only has to determine whether there's a risk in a scientific sense, but also whether that risk is unreasonable, which requires it in the same step to consider costs and benefits of the chemical and of regulating that chemical, availability of alternatives, and so forth. It also requires that when EPA decides there is an unreasonable risk, it has to regulate based on imposing what it is able to demonstrate is the least burdensome of all possible regulatory options it might have imposed. And this is all to be done without any definition or criteria as to what constitutes a risky chemical or not in the statute. This has proven to be unworkable. The last time EPA tried to regulate a chemical under TSCA was in 1989, when it issued regulations banning most uses of asbestos, immediately challenged in court, and in 1991, the Fifth Circuit ruled throughout essentially the full regulation, arguing that EPA had not met its burden of proving that it had imposed the least burdensome of all possible alternatives. So clearly, everybody, I think, agrees this is a place that needs significant fixes. The good news is that CSIA does go directly at those problems. The standard that it applies, which is still the term unreasonable risk, is clarified to be a health-only standard. It is to be applied based solely on considerations of human health and the environment. It simply strikes the language that required the least burdensome requirements to be identified by EPA. And it deals with a number of issues that get at the heart of trying to address risks in the real world. So it's looking at the fact that there are exposures to vulnerable populations that need to be looked at differently to those from the general population. It's recognizing that multiple sources of exposure to a chemical are out there and need to be considered. And it has a general proviso that EPA utilize the best available science. But there are some issues here. Even though, generally speaking, a cost-benefit approach has been rejected, in other words, there's been a distinction made between the science decision about whether a chemical is risky or not and the costs and other factors that go into deciding what to do about that in the risk management phase of that chemical. That separation is generally there in the bill, but when EPA is to propose a ban or a phase-out of a chemical, it comes back in. There's also not an explicit requirement that EPA protect vulnerable populations, only that they consider the higher exposure or susceptibility of those populations. And similarly, I think a lot of people think that the National Academy reports on risk assessment lay out what should be regarded as best available science as of currently anyway, but there's not an explicit reference to that in the bill. TSCA divides the universe into existing and new chemicals, and the existing chemicals that were on the market, some 60,000 of them as Martin mentioned, were grandfathered in with no mandate and no requirement that EPA evaluate their safety. That lack of a mandate has meant that very few of those chemicals, an estimated 2% of those 60,000 chemicals, have ever been evaluated for safety. There's also a presumption that if there is not data showing a problem, the presumption is that there is no risk to that chemical. And there are no criteria by which EPA can say we need to look at these chemicals that trigger certain criteria in a review process. The CSIA would address many of these issues. First, it sets up a mandate that EPA actually assess the safety of all chemicals in commerce, however long that takes. It challenges this notion that lack of data is necessarily an evidence of lack of risk by indicating that EPA can designate chemicals as high priority and require testing and assessment based on the absence of sufficient data. High hazard or high exposure are sufficient to trigger that high priority designation, and every chemical that is so designated has to go through a safety assessment and determination, and if that determination finds the chemical fails to meet the standard, there's a mandatory duty for EPA to issue a regulation that ensures that that chemical, under new conditions, would meet that. That's the good news. Again, there's a lot of problems here. That initial prioritization step, EPA is forbidden from requiring additional testing. So it is to be based solely on information already at hand. And we know that lots of chemicals have insufficient information for making that judgment. There is nothing in the bill as drafted that sets a pace for all of this to happen, except general language that EPA should seek to do this expeditiously. Moreover, when EPA decides that a chemical is either high or low priority, that's essentially a decision that is beyond challenge. And I think in general, people feel okay about that if it leads to further consideration. But in the way the bill is drafted, a low priority designation actually has preemptive effect on state authority, even though it's not able to be challenged by anyone who disagrees with that decision. New chemicals. There is generally a fairly passive approach to new chemicals under TSCA, and while there is a review required before a new chemical can enter the market, the burden is on EPA to find a problem, and they have very little data typically to look at when they are when they're looking at that new chemical to determine whether there is a problem. And in addition, most of the details of that evaluation never see the light of day, in part because of the cloaking of a lot of that information because of confidential business considerations. The CSIA would tackle a number of things in this arena. First, for the first time, it would establish a requirement that EPA affirmatively make a decision about a chemical, not simply say, we don't see any red flags here based on the limited information we have. Instead, they would have to say that the chemical, there's sufficient information to find that it is likely to meet the safety standard. EPA also has the ability to prohibit or place restrictions on that chemical using order authority, and not have to go through a full rulemaking in order to do so. And significantly more of the information and deliberative documents that EPA developed would have to be made public. However, there are problems here. EPA is forbidden, unlike current TSCA, from requiring testing of new chemicals. So if insufficient data are available on a chemical, EPA's only option is to suspend that review. That does provide an incentive, arguably, for the company to come up with the data. But that is a significant retreat from current TSCA. And once EPA determines that a chemical is or isn't likely to meet the safety standard, there's no way to lock in the compliance with those conditions for other manufacturers. There's some lingo here I won't have time to go into. I'm not going to have time to go through all of these sections, but I wanted to give you a flavor for how the bill does, in fact, address a number of the key concerns here, but remain a lot of problems remain with it. So I'm just going to flash through these so that you can look at them later at your own leisure. There's issues around testing, confidential business information, Probably the big kahuna here is preemption, the preemption of state authority. So I'd be happy to answer some questions about that, but I do want to spend the last 2 minutes talking about another overarching concern about the bill as drafted. Because there are very few deadlines and there are lots of new procedures that EPA would have to put in place to start to act, one of the big concerns that, frankly, all stakeholders are concerned about is that it could take a very long time for EPA to start making decisions under this law. The industry stakeholders who want to see TSCA reform because they need a new referee out there that's making decisions don't want to have to wait a decade for EPA to be getting to their chemicals. Likewise, the health and environmental advocates don't want to wait for that decade either. I've gone through the bill in very significant detail and developed a very conservative timeline for how long it would take to actually implement the bill. And I've got some statistics here that give you a sense. The first step in the process is for EPA to develop a list of prioritizations of chemicals. That would take over 3 years. To get to the first safety determination of a chemical, over 7 years. And if a rule were required to impose risk management, that would be another year and a half minimum, probably longer. That's a situation that's really very unacceptable to just about everybody who's looked at it. This bill is a work in progress. There's some negotiations that have been underway for a while that are moving it in the right direction. They still have quite a ways to go, I think. But these are some of the kinds of key improvements needed. More structure, deadlines, time frames for moving chemicals through the pipeline that's set up, defining and explicitly protecting vulnerable populations. The preemption of state authority is currently way too broad from our perspective and can and does need to be narrowed significantly. Ensuring that the lack of information doesn't lead to decisions that are not supportable and have consequences such as preempting others from acting. And then finally, making sure EPA has enough resources to do all of this. Thank you very much. I'd be very happy to answer any questions you have, and there's a lot more information in the slides that I skipped over very quickly, as well as on these websites.
I do have a couple clarifying questions, and then why don't speakers come up and we have about 20 minutes for discussion.
Yeah.
Out of question.
There were two other members of the committee on the Democratic side that co-sponsored the bill, Senators Tom Udall from New Mexico and Kristen Gillibrand from New York. For a while, it looked like perhaps Gillibrand would be the one that took up the mantle, but it's ended up being Tom Udall. But there are actually five Democrats on that, including Gillibrand, also Merkley, Whitehouse, and Carper, who are working together to try to both move and improve the bill. The chair of the committee is Barbara Boxer from California. She was a little bit blindsided by this bill, and she also is very concerned about any preemption of California. So she has been fairly hostile to it. But I think is slowly getting to a point of engaging at least in seeing whether it could be negotiated to a point that she would allow it to go to markup in her committee. That's still in play. The House of Representatives has also been looking at this bill. In fact, they're having a hearing next week on the Senate bill in the House. It's a sort of unusual thing. So I think there's still a fair bit of momentum behind it, but the jury is still out as to where it's going to go.
Yes.
I was just kind of curious about the state preemption. How severe is it?
So I'm sorry, I didn't have more time on this. We understand that the Vitter bill was going to have something very close to what would be called full field preemption. You pass a law, no states can do anything. It's very far from that, even though I think it's still way too broad. It does require EPA to act on a particular chemical in order to preempt a state, either existing requirement or new requirement on that chemical. The problem is, the primary problem is that it sets the trigger very early in the EPA process for preempting new state requirements. So literally at the time when EPA decides this is either a high or a low priority chemical, no state could enact a new requirement on that chemical. That could be 10 years before EPA actually gets through the pipeline to the end of a decision. Similarly, the bill is written in a way that can be read as preempting a lot of different things. For example, prohibitions on chemicals for reducing greenhouse gas concerns or addressing air quality like the ozone levels. So I think it's a mix of things that are really going to be addressed through clarification of the scope of the preemption, and then some real tough issues that are going to come between, because part of the reason the industry came to the table is they're being driven crazy by all these state requirements. So some sort of balance is going to have to get struck. We think it's gone too far in the direction of preemption, but you know, we'll see what happens.
Let's open it up for questions to any of the speakers. Yes, in the back. We'll try to figure out.
And the one you're just speaking.
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about how the ISA, what the burden is for people in proving the chemicals, and then also for recourse of consumers under this law?
I'm not sure I understood the question. Yes, okay. So I would say there's often a discussion about shifting the burden of proof. The European model has been one that's based on shifting the burden from the government and the people to industry to show safety of its products. The debate is a little different in the U.S., and I think what the bill tries to do and does partway is shift the presumption from one that chemicals are safe in the absence of evidence of harm to a presumption that there needs to be evidence of safety in order for a chemical to enter the market or to remain on the market. And I think that shift is probably at least as profound as shifting it from government to industry. EPA would be doing the assessments, but they would have an obligation to find affirmative evidence of safety for a chemical to remain on the market. TSCA does have a provision already that allows citizens to sue for actions or to change actions that EPA takes. The citizen suit provision, as well as a citizen petition process where anyone can go to EPA and request that they regulate a particular chemical or take another action. And if EPA denies that petition, then there's legal recourse there as well. That obviously, these things cut both ways because an industry interest who doesn't like a decision or a community interest who doesn't like a decision both have access to those provisions.
Speakers, you can also feel free to add comments or questions for each other. Yes?
Is it still true that a lot of people who may be making these decisions at the EPA might be old industry, might have strong industry ties?
Cal, you want to answer that?
Yeah. Okay, you know, I'm from EDA. I would suggest.
She used to be at EDF.
And I used to be an environmental defense fund. I think people, I'd like to believe that, like me, come to EDA because we want to engage in public service. And I think people come from many different sectors and come to the table. I'd say that there are often lively debates about the science. And that's a good thing.
Yes, in the back.
You know, I had a question for you, Paolo, about the stakeholders. You mentioned the stakeholder process in design for the environment. Could you explain actually who are the stakeholders, how are they chosen, how chosen, how are they engaged?
Right.
Can everyone hear in the back, or should I make her come and stand at the microphone?
Okay, so the question is, who are our stakeholders that inform DFE decision-making? And they represent a broad swath of sectors. So we have representatives from companies that formulate products. We have representatives from retailers who sell products. We have representatives from environmental nonprofits. And a variety of consultants and other folks who are interested in it. It's not a hand-picked list. This is not a, what is it called when the, it's not convened under FACA. So that means it doesn't have to have specific composition and folks who've been selected. So it's a self-selected group of folks who are interested in what we're doing and feel that they have a stake in it.
I'll just add my two cents on that subject, that it can be very difficult for consumers and environmental health representatives to find the resources to participate actively in these stakeholder processes, and that can be a significant problem in getting broad perspectives. Shelley, you had a question? The question was about what lists are used to decide that chemicals have certain biological properties that might be of concern.
Well, there are a couple things. I think as a toxicologist kind of obsessed with the data, I participate in a lot of conversations with different groups of stakeholders on how do we evaluate toxicological data against criteria. How do we determine what's a concern and what's not a concern? So I think, like on the science level, there are very vibrant conversations about how to evaluate chemicals, and we do have on the global scale GHS criteria, globally harmonized system of classification and labeling, and that is very much a model for how to evaluate criteria under the design for the environment scheme. So I do think that as far as evaluating chemicals and evaluating data and the structure activity relationships and the models that are available, they're not that far off. There are slight differences here and there, but at that level, I think we're not that far off from harmonization. I think the harder part, the bigger question in my mind, is one of trade-offs. Because chemicals aren't usually not just one thing. You know, oh, we found a chemical that's not a reproductive toxicant, but oops, it's a VOC. How do you balance those trade-offs? And that's a conversation that goes beyond the science and into the policy realm of how do we make these decisions when faced with these kind of complex this complex array of properties.
And enormous gaps in whether chemicals have been tested at all with respect to what might get them on a list or not. Yeah?
Maybe I didn't spend enough time on it, but on one of my slides I talk about the implications of our label analysis on the online rating systems. And those rating systems are great in that they pull together lots of information for consumers, but unfortunately they have the same amount of information that we have if we were to go to the store, and in that they only can base their judgment by what's on the label. And based on our analysis and others, is that label is not always complete, so unfortunately they're also left with incomplete information. So. While it's kind of a great data aggregation, they're kind of stuck as much as we are in terms of the regulations on labeling.
And Robin's study actually found a situation in testing of sunscreens where one that was very favorably rated online and based on the label had the highest number of target compounds in our study. Yeah. That's a great question, and others may want to comment on it. I think price is an issue. When we think about recommendations, we like to think about strategies for reducing the number of products, which is not an expensive choice. But I think that there are issues about potential marketing of products to particularly vulnerable communities. For example, we're thinking a lot about marketing of products to African American girls. There was a paper published just yesterday from the Breast Cancer and Environment Research Program showing a falling age of puberty, particularly among African American girls, and a concern that some products being marketed specifically as hair straighteners or skin products used by these girls might have hormonal components, even like placenta, which is very hormonally rich, obviously, or that these communities are not as able to make choices to avoid some of the mainstream chemicals that we're concerned about.
So I think the point is exactly correct that particularly for low-income people, price is a significant driver. Product choices they make. And consumer product manufacturers are sensitive to that. In the slide you didn't see, that showed four overlapping circles, one was labeled price and the other was labeled performance. And you have premium products that have very high performance, tend to have a high price. You also have value brands, which tend to have a much lower price, but also poor performance, and also contain a large number of very low cost but more toxic substances than would a more premium product. I think it's a significant issue, and it's just another example of discrimination through environmental, sociological, and other factors.
And I'd just add one other thing. I think even if all things were equal in terms of product exposures, if you will, the disparities are rooted in a lot of other factors. So science is telling us increasingly that susceptibility to chemical exposures is a function not only of the exposure per se, but pre-existing health status, access to health care, diet and nutrition, what other chemical and non-chemical factors one might be exposed to. So communities that are exposed to multiple sources of environmental contaminants would be expected to be more susceptible even to the same level of exposure to a consumer product as a different population. So the complexities, but also the interlocking nature of a lot of different factors, I think is increasingly what the science is pointing to. And there's now a number of studies that show those very direct connections in asthma and a chemical exposure and overlaid by socioeconomic factors.
I think we have time for one more, so take it. Anybody want to comment?
I'm an optimist, so I do think things are moving incrementally in the right direction. And I think some of it is a growing recognition that this is a problem, that our policies, the state of knowledge or the lack thereof, are actual problems. So, you know, a lot of chemical companies have come to the table finally in pushing for a stronger federal system at a time when many members of Congress are trying to take power away from EPA. They're trying to give them more power, and a lot of it is because they recognize that there's a crisis in confidence around their products. And they may not agree necessarily with me on whether chemical X is a problem or not, but there is agreement that if enough people think chemical X is a problem and there's nobody out there who's actually doing the evaluation of it, that's a problem for them as much as it is for us. So that's a move in the right direction. I think the fact that others have stepped up to fill the void left at the federal system, be it states, be it retailers or product manufacturers, that's another fact. I think just the general level of awareness and recognition of the need to act has grown significantly in the last decade or so.
And on that note, I'd like to thank all of you for being here and being part of the solution. It's really great to have a full room of people caring about these issues, and I think that's what is going to make a difference for creating change in the future. Thanks so much.